Good afternoon and welcome to the Mises Institute. My name is Jason Kingery and I'm the communications coordinator for YAL this year. The Young Americans for Liberty is a nationwide chapter-based educational nonprofit organization. So we're about 900 chapters strong. We have a chapter on almost every major American campus in the United States. We are formerly Young Americans for Ron Paul. So back in 2012, his presidential campaign, he garnered enough support amongst the young university crowd that they started to form chapters across the U.S. And after the campaign was over, we had such a large, mobilized, well-communicating group of students that that's just kept going. So we're continuing to grow, and we spread the message of personal and economic liberty on American campuses. It's been a goal of ours this year to put together a forum like this and try to make it free for everyone who wanted to come, specifically university students, to be able to attend. I didn't think that we would be able to do it at the Mises Institute, but they have invited us in and made it possible for us to host this here today via their contributors, and I think we should thank them for their contribution to the age group that I think is most influential in the United States today. So today we have an exciting lineup of distinguished speakers. Dr. Mark Thornton, Chris Calton, and Tho Bishop are all going to give us an in-depth economic, historic, and judicial analysis of the war on drugs in the U.S. Each speaker will lecture for around 40 minutes, and then they're open to questions immediately after. We will take a short break in between each lecture. And afterwards, we're going to attempt to get two group photos. I think if the weather permits, we're going to go outside for the first one. And then for the second one, we'll do it. Actually, we should do this one first and then the one outside second. So in the essence of time, I'm going to yield to Max Ogburn. He's going to introduce our first speaker, Dr. Mark Thornton.
Hello, everyone. I'm Max Ogburn. I'm a member of Young Americans for Liberty and an undergraduate student of economics at Auburn University. I have also been granted the extraordinary opportunity of working a research internship here at the Mises Institute under the direction of our first speaker, Dr. Mark Thornton. Dr. Thornton is a senior fellow at the Mises Institute, an accomplished writer and economic theorist. He has written and been featured in several publications, including the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics, the Free Market Review of Austrian Economics, and the Journal of Libertarian Studies. Dr. Thornton served as editor of the Austrian Economics Newsletter and was a member of the editorial board of the Journal of Libertarian Studies and several other academic journals. He's been featured in publications such as Barron's, Bloomberg, The Economist, Forbes, The New York Times, USA Today, and The Wall Street Journal, and has had editorials published in many prominent regional newspapers. He has served as a member of the graduate faculties of Auburn University and Columbus State University. He has also taught economics at Auburn University at Montgomery and Trinity University in Texas. I recently read his most recent book, The Skyscraper Curse, and how Austrian economists predicted every major crisis of the last century, and I would recommend it to anyone who is interested in better understanding the role that central banking plays in economic instability. However, we assembled today to talk about the effects of and alternatives to drug policy. The consequences of the war on drugs have long been a point of interest to Dr. Thornton, as his doctoral dissertation was The Economics of Prohibition, which has been published as a book under that title. He has continued his work in this area more recently by raising awareness of the institutional causes and economic effects of the opioid crisis. So without taking any more of his or your time, I'd like to welcome to the podium Dr. Mark Thornton.
Thank you very much, Max, and thank you all for being here today, taking your time out of the holiday weekend to come celebrate 420 here. I didn't even really realize that was a sort of a legalization holiday until a couple years ago, and I've been working on this for most of my adult life. So I want to thank everybody for coming to the Mises Institute today and applaud the efforts of the local chapter of YAL. Great job. And the Mises Institute was founded in 1982 by Lou Rockwell and moved to Auburn the next year, where I just happened to be studying graduate economics. So I'm probably one of the luckiest persons in the entire world. The Mises Institute is a nonprofit economics education institute. We teach Austrian economics and libertarian political theory through a variety of means. And for college students, we have the Mises University Conference coming up in mid-July, and I encourage everybody to either attend or to encourage other people, college students, to attend that event. It's our big conference of the year. I've got two purposes here today. One is to try to convey to you something very specific about the war on drugs and prohibition more generally. But in the background, I also want to try to get across to you the differences between the Austrian school of economics and mainstream economics. Okay, there are some free market mainstream economists, but the key dividing line between Austrians and everybody else is at a very fundamental level. We do things fundamentally different to try to get the right answer as much as possible. In terms of teaching or you learning something specific about the war on drugs or prohibition more generally is that there's three main general causes why we get sucked into adopting prohibitions against various things. The first is prejudice. Almost all prohibitions through history have been the result of the majority of Americans voting against a minority in certain cases. So the WASPs outvoted the newly migrated Catholics, the Irish, the Italians, so forth, and they banned alcohol because the WASPs weren't big drinkers, but the Irish and the Italians were. And so they thought that they could get that group by banning alcohol. So prejudice is one of the three P's of prohibition. The second one is propaganda. Of course, and you'll see a great deal about that today from one of the presenters, Mr. Carlton, that the government uses propaganda to drum up support for getting themselves more power. Okay, so you make the case and you create ignorance amongst the population with respect to certain things like alcohol and cannabis. So propaganda is a key driver for prohibition. And then finally, there's the public health concern or the public goods concern that we should ban a particular drug or alcohol because that would improve public health. It would improve things not just for addicts and users, but it would improve things more generally for everybody in the population. So I'm going to concentrate on that third one, the public health concern, because that's the only legitimate justification for prohibition, is that it improves not just the health of addicts and users, consumers, but it helps everybody by prettying up society and causing fewer social ills and improving public health. So those are the three P's of prohibition. And then more globally, there's politics. And I know a lot of you in here today are interested in politics. You talk about politics. You want to change politics. But in order to change politics, you have to know what it is. So if you look at the term more closely and carefully, what you see is poly, which is Greek for many, multiples of, and ticks, which are blood-sucking parasites. And then you have some idea of what politics really is. It's a bunch, a large number of blood-sucking parasites. Okay, so economics. Austrian economists have contributed a great deal to the foundations of economic analysis. Primarily, it's something called price theory. You've all heard of supply and demand determining the price of something. And when things change in the economy, the price is the mechanism which brings everything into equilibrium. So if there's a decrease in supply of something, then the price rises in order to keep things harmonious between producers and consumers. Producers, the lowest cost producers, produce that lower amount, and the highest valued consumers end up consuming the amount produced. But it creates equilibrium, it creates harmony in the marketplace, in society. The marketplace is just a microcosm of society. So price theory is very important. It's most of what we do. Principles of economics classes, most of those classes are devoted towards explaining price theory, how it functions, why it functions, what are the results of a well-functioning marketplace in the economy. So it's fundamental, not just for Austrians, but it's fundamental for almost all different types of economists, save the Keynesians and the Marxist. So it's the bedrock foundation of what economic analysis is. And when it comes to prohibition, that's unfortunate. Because people, whether you're a professional mainstream economist or whether you are a prohibitionist or a drug warrior, all of those people think in terms of supply and demand and price theory. Okay, so in their mind, prohibition or the war on drugs is meant to suppress the production, distribution, and consumption of a particular drug. Okay, so if you suppress the supply, you raise the price, and they even say prohibition is like a tax in the sense that if you put a tax on something that limits supply and raises price, and limits consumption. So whether you're a mainstream economist or you're a drug warrior prohibitionist, everybody is thinking strictly in terms of price theory. That's not the way it is in Austrian economics because prohibition changes everything. So when you put a tax on something, everything else remains the same. Supply is decreased, price rises, and quantity consumed goes down. But with prohibition, everything changes about the market, and price is almost irrelevant. So Austrians focus in on the destruction of the free market in the case of prohibition and its replacement with a black market or underground economy. So that's a big difference between the Austrian School of Economics and mainstream economics. It's not just like a tax because prohibition changes everything. It changes how the product is made. Okay? Currently, for example, with alcohol, you have distilleries and breweries that have to compete with one another for their customers. They have to transmit information about their product into the marketplace. They're subject to lawsuits. They're subject to the vagaries of competition. We've seen this recently with Bud Light, Coors Light, and Miller Light. They're all leveling information about their opponents or their competitors' product into the marketplace. So one says, well, they make theirs with corn syrup. And another one says, well, you know, this isn't really fresh water that they're using or whatever it happens to be. They're all in a fight transmitting information to us, trying to win out in the competitive marketplace. But we know in the marketplace, things are made pretty good. I mean, if you go to the supermarket even, and you go to the pain relieving area of the pharmacy in the supermarket, you'll find many competing products. You'll find aspirin, you'll find generic aspirin, you'll find all sorts of substitutes. You'll find that some is the regular strength, some is super strength, and others are maximum strength. So you're given choices, you're given information about the product, you're given a competitive price, and if any of those companies hurt you and didn't tell you about the risks of using their product, you can sue them in a court of law. The Tylenol company, for example, back in the early 1980s, there were some murders in Chicago, Illinois, and 9 people lost their lives because they took Tylenol pills that were laced with arsenic. And so you see what happened to the Tylenol company. The parent company, Johnson & Johnson's stock lost 25% in a matter of days. They spent $100 million advertising to not take their product, and they bought back every bottle they could find. Even if it didn't have any pills in it, they would still buy it back. And in the wake of that tragedy, Tylenol invented the caplet, which you couldn't pull apart anymore and add things in. An invention that now all companies, or most companies, have adopted. And they also adopted the tamper-proof top on the bottle so that Tylenol customers knew that their product was safe and everybody else knew that their product was safe. Okay, now that's not the way it works in illegal black markets for drugs nowadays. Those kind of conditions, those kind of requirements just aren't there at all. The products are made by non-professionals very often. They're made badly. They're made with impurities. What we saw during alcohol prohibition was the liquor that was made in the black market smelled so bad and tasted so bad, bartenders in speakeasies had to come up with ways to overcome the odor and the taste. And so one of the bright sides, I guess you'd say, of alcohol prohibition is it introduced the age of the cocktail, where bartenders were adding fruit juices, adding dairy products, adding herbs and spices, all sorts of things to try to be able to sell their product. So again, in prohibited markets, things are made badly. In terms of transporting, of course, that has to be done under the threat that you could be captured and sent to jail by moving illegal drugs from, say, South America into the United States. You have to travel a long distance, and at any one point, you could be stopped, confiscated, and thrown in jail. As a consequence of that, the distribution of illegal drugs drives drugs to be made as potently as possible. Okay, if you can make it into a smaller package and you can carry more packages and you can get more bang for your buck, essentially. So prohibition drives up the potency of illegal drugs. When I did my dissertation, I sent off to the government's marijuana monitoring project in Mississippi and got a report about the history of cannabis or marijuana potency. And at the beginning of their study in 1972, the average potency of marijuana was 0.4 of 1%, or half a percent. The ending of the data that I got was 1984, and the average potency of marijuana was 4.4%. So the potency of marijuana in 12 years had increased by 1,000%. Now, of course, it's even much higher, and the illegal drug distributors have switched from cannabis to cocaine and heroin and methamphetamines, because those are more concentrated drugs, so you can move and conceal more doses of the drugs, and while facing a similar risk of being caught as a result. So potency essentially the danger of consuming something goes up tremendously as a result of prohibition and the war on drugs. And then there are other effects. But the first two effects, let me just relate it back to my original purpose, which was public health. Okay, is the government's war on drug really promoting better public health? The results seem to suggest quite the opposite. More dangerous drugs made by non-professionals under non-commercial production facilities results in a much more dangerous, much more deadly product. And so in my dissertation, I was able to show that the more money they spent enforcing the war on drugs, the more people died as a result of drug overdoses, and the more people who showed up at emergency rooms with drug overdose-like symptoms, the numbers shot up, and the more they spent, the more people died, the more people ended up in the hospital, and the more people ended up addicted to these drugs as a result. So the public health basis of the war on drugs simply does not exist. The more they tried to enforce the war on drugs, the more people died. And of course, there's no legal recourse in the black market. So if you're harmed in any way, you don't have any recourse like you do in the legal marketplace, with the Tylenol company spending oodles of money coming up with new inventions on the spot and compensating the victims of that tragedy. So it's completely different. It's absolutely completely different when you go from a commercialized marketplace to a black market. Another issue is crime. You could take crime under that rubric of public health. The prohibitionists say if we could prohibit these markets, then that would drive down the rate of crime. You wouldn't have people trying to steal in order to finance their habits and so forth if they weren't addicted in the first place. But the exact opposite is really the result. Crime goes up. Innocent people are hurt. Gang wars, which we have almost 3 million gang members in the United States. Gangs are a business to sell drugs on the street. That's what brings those people together. And then it inevitably leads to conflicts between gangs. And so there's a lot of violence in gang territories and between gang gang territories as a result. So crime goes up. In the my dissertation, I showed that in 1919, the year before alcohol prohibition was started, going back a few years, the murder rate in the United States was 5 murders for every 100,000 population. And that went back several years. After prohibition, alcohol prohibition went into effect, and organized crime came to dominate the American scene, the murder rate went up to 9.5 per murders for every 100,000 population. So roughly the murder rate doubled. And once they repealed prohibition in 1933, during the midst of the Great Depression, the murder rate fell right back to 5. So it normalized the murder rate, brought it down by 50%. Crime also fell. And this puzzles historians and sociologists who think that poor, you know, in when people are poor, they're more likely to create, to make crimes and to steal from others and kill others and so forth. But that didn't happen. It actually was a reverse of their theory, their anti-capitalist theory, really, which says that, you know, if capitalism fails or there's a business cycle crisis, that crime will go up. But that didn't happen because of the repeal of prohibition during 1932. The war on drugs is also the biggest cause of political corruption. Okay, so you all know about organized crime and the Sopranos and all of that the Chicago crime syndicates, the New York crime syndicates. What's going on there? Well, basically, organized crime bribes the local police. It bribes the local judges. It bribes politicians in a particular area. And it says, don't go after us. Just leave our people alone. And we'll tell you who's trying to get into our territory and where they live and how to capture them. So it's one group getting protection, and they're protected from the police, the courts, and politics, basically. And they tell on their competitors that are trying to maybe getting in on their turf. And so they create a monopoly situation. But it's a monopoly situation that creates a bunch of crime, too. Okay, you've seen the shows like The Sopranos and historical episodes, and it's very often a murderous type of result. I think I saw in passing recently that I think in New York, one mobster had his close competitor bumped off, so to speak, or murdered. So in no case, if you look at all the consequences of moving from a free market under competitive conditions, under a legal system, you see a well-functioning, violent-free, basically, environment. When you go to a prohibited black market, such as the war on drugs, you not only drive down public health, create more addicts, create more overdoses, create more emergency room visits, but you also hurt the broader public, okay, because you're creating more crime, you're creating more innocent victims in society, and you're also destabilizing politics through this bribery and corruption business. And this has really reached the height of an amazing height in Central American countries such as Honduras and Nicaragua, Costa Rica, because the United States has stopped the transportation of drugs from South America into the United States by air and by sea, using various devices such as the U.S. military, but they can't stop it from the land bridge from South America to North America, which is Central America. And so the drug cartels have gone into these countries and they've hollowed out a transportation network where basically the states are failing in those countries. The drug cartels threaten the local cops. They threaten the local judges. They threaten the local politicians. They threaten even the military in those countries. They actually can outgun the local militias and the local militaries in those countries. And then they intimidate the local population. They say to a 14-year-old boy, you're going to become part of this organization, or we're going to kill your parents, or we're going to kill your younger sister. So it's life is intolerable in those countries because of our war on drugs. It certainly hasn't stopped the flow of drugs in to any extent, but it's basically caused Central American countries to be failed states where crime and intimidation is rampant, murder, rape, all of that goes on in very large numbers in those countries. And that's why people in those countries, even children on their own, have made the dangerous journey from Central America into the United States. And so we've seen these waves of people that are coming to the United States, and the reason they're trying to get here is to leave a life that, without all of that constant brutal intimidation and violence in those countries. So the ramifications of our war on drugs is something that has global effects around the world, and we're basically the main driver of world drug prohibition, essentially, and it's causing a lot of people a lot of pain, and it does the public no good. Thank you.